This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Marilyn Robinson's new novel, Gilead, is a meditation on religion, family, war, and finding meaning in life. Reviewing it in the Washington Post, Michael Derda wrote that the novel is so serenely beautiful and written in prose so gravely measured and thoughtful that one feels touched with grace just to read it. This is Robinson's first novel since the publication of her 1981 book, Housekeeping. Gilead is set in 1956 in the town of Gilead, Iowa. The story is told in the form of a letter written by a 76-year-old Congregationalist minister to his 7-year-old son. The minister believes he is near death and is passing on the story of his life. The story encompasses the lives of his father, a pacifist, and his grandfather, who fought with John Brown and the abolitionists and lost an eye in the Civil War. Marilyn Robinson lives in Iowa and teaches at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. She belongs to the Congregationalist Church and is a former deacon. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of the novel as the father explains to his son that he's dying.
I don't know how many times people have asked me what death is like, sometimes when they were only an hour or two from finding out for themselves. Even when I was a very young man, people as old as I am now would ask me, hold on to my hands and look into my eyes with their old milky eyes, as if they knew I knew when they were going to make me tell them. I used to say it was like going home. We have no home in this world, I used to say. And then I'd walk back up the road to this old place and make myself a pot of coffee and a fried egg sandwich and listen to the radio, when I got one, in the dark as often as not. Do you remember this house? I think you must a little. I grew up in parsonages. I've lived in this one most of my life, and I've visited in a good many others, because my father's friends and most of our relatives also lived in parsonages. And when I thought about it in those days, which wasn't too often, I thought this was the worst of them all, the draftiest and the dreariest. Well, that was my state of mind at the time. It's a perfectly good old house, but I was all alone in it then, and that made it seem strange to me. I didn't feel very much at home in the world. That was a fact. Now I do.
That's Marilyn Robinson reading from her new novel, Gilead. Your novel, Gilead, is written in the form of a letter. It's this minister, John Ames, in his 70s, who believes he is dying, writing a letter to his 7-year-old son that he hopes his son will read much later in life. And, you know, a lot of people advise beginning writers, write as if you're writing a letter home or a letter to your best friend, and that will help capture your most direct and natural voice. Did writing this novel in the form of a letter from father to son help in any way?
Well, writing a novel is an odd thing. The situation occurred to me as something that simply I wanted to enter into. I have never myself particularly liked to read epistolary novels, and I guess that's basically what this one is. But the given of this of the novel for me from the beginning was that he would be in this situation where he's speaking very lovingly to an adult man whom he will never know, his grown son, and trying to, in effect, be a father to someone who's much too young to actually remember him as father at the time that he imagines he will die. So I could almost say that I surprised myself. This isn't a kind of form that I would ever have imagined that I would choose to write in. I felt that I could do it because I knew the voice of the writer. I felt very strongly that I knew who this character was. So that it wasn't a problem, but it also wasn't a resource for me either.
The novel is written, I mean, he's writing this letter to his son in 1956, and he's in his 70s. So it's really, in a way, he's using the language of another era, and he's also a fairly... I shouldn't use the word formal exactly, but I mean he's not a frivolous man by
no,
any means.
He's not.
So you know, the language you use very much reflects that. Like, instead of calling somebody, you know, nervous or fidgety, you'll write, He was the most unreposeful human being I ever knew. Can you talk a little bit about the language that seemed to suit the voice of this minister in 1956?
Well, one of the things that was characteristic in that tradition is that they were very highly educated people. And one of the things that they did do was establish many of the colleges that are scattered through the Middle West, places like Oberlin and Grinnell and Knox College, Carleton College, and so on, very fine little institutions that they established in the first instance as good liberal arts colleges, which were also on the Underground Railroad and egalitarian racially and so on before the Civil War. There was a very strong intellectual tradition, and he has a sort of, you know, he has that sort of refinement about him in the first place. In the second place, he is writing to his son, and he, as he says, you know, he wants to give a candid version of his better self or something to that effect. In other words, not to be too distant, but on the other hand, also to present himself in a way that the son can respect, you know.
There's a sermon that he writes in, I think it's 1918. The flu pandemic is sweeping around the world and killing many people. And the United States has entered World War I, and a lot of soldiers who are preparing to go to Europe to fight in that war are dying here of the flu. And he's trying to think about what to tell the parents who are coming to church. Can you talk a little bit about what he thinks about telling them and why he decides to never actually give that sermon?
Well, he thinks of telling them that it is God's way of saying don't enter war. And, you know, that if you have the option of doing it, don't do it. He lets the parents believe that he means that they're being spared the trenches and the mustard gas of the First World War. But what he means more profoundly is that God is sparing them the act of killing, which from his point of view, of course, is a greater rescue.
But he actually never gives that sermon. He burns it.
Yes.
Why does he burn it?
Well, it's a continuous problem, I think, that ministers have, that they're often speaking to people who actually agree with them. He doesn't have, among the people that come to his church through this pandemic when many, many things simply closed down, there are people who he knows are as heartbroken about all this death and all the warfare and so on as he is. So he sees no point in assuming the posture of preaching against something that he knows that everyone in the room is in grief about already.
Your minister, your main character, says, "For me, writing has always felt like praying, even when I wasn't writing prayers, as I was often enough." Is writing like praying for you?
I suppose it is. I sometimes think it's more like praying than praying is. I mean, in the sense that it, you have concrete evidence of what you have done and what you have shied away from and so on. Very interesting.
I don't think I quite get it. Tell me more about how for you the process of writing compares to prayer.
Well, I think it's a very hard thing to say, perhaps because people have different ideas and experiences related to prayer. For me, it's a kind of meditation. And I think that writing certainly is meditative in the sense that you have to feel that it answers to some standard of truth, however oblique the relationship of fiction to truth might be in the usual understanding of it.
You know, you're writing from the point of view of a minister, and I think you get to a lot of interesting things that a minister must experience. Like you write, you're describing a scene in which he's passing a group of people who are joking around with each other, but as soon as they see the minister, they stop joking. And the minister writes, That's the strangest thing about this life, about being in the ministry. People change the subject when they see you coming. And then sometimes those very same people come into your study and tell you the most remarkable things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I get a fair amount of mail and email and so on from ministers and priests and so on. And they confirm this, that on the one hand they are rather isolated, and on the other hand they are on terms of remarkable intimacy, often with people who have not treated them, you know, as people with whom they were familiar or at ease until confession or until counseling or whatever, you know.
I guess they're treated really differently when someone's alone in the room with them than in a group.
Yes, I think that's very true. And also, when they're fulfilling the role that they have, mm-hmm, of helping people to make sense of grief or crisis or anger or whatever, then of course they have to be privy to remarkable things.
So why do a lot of ministers write to you?
I think one of the main reasons is because ministers and priests are very used to being described in most unflattering terms in literature. And they're, I think, quite pleased in general to find that I've made a character who is likable, positive, intelligent, not a hypocrite.
Something else about your character, John Ames, the minister, he lost his young wife and their baby in childbirth, and then he was alone for decades until in his 60s he meets and marries a younger woman with whom he is deeply in love, and she is deeply in love with him, and it's a beautiful marriage. They have a son, and this is the son who he's writing to, and the whole novel is the letter to his son. But anyways, during those decades when he was lonely, when he had no wife and had no child, he felt very much on the outside of life. Do you comprehend that feeling of being on the outside of life, being set apart?
Oh, I suppose I do. I frankly, I don't know what it feels like to be anyone else. So I don't know how I compare with other people in terms of my familiarity with that experience. I think that that a lot of people spend a lot of their time feeling as if life is something that sort of goes on around them because other people's lives always appear perhaps more comprehensible than their own. I mean, what you see people do seems understandable because you don't understand their doubt or their anxiety or their duplicity or whatever else might be a factor in their behavior.
Your character confesses that through the long years that he lived alone, he, quote, suffered at the spectacle of all marriages, all the households overflowing with children. And he thinks he's guilty of violating the 10th commandment, the commandment that says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, neither shalt thou desire his servant, nor his handmaiden, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is his. And he thinks that this 10th commandment is the commandment that there can be no law against. No one can punish you for coveting, I mean, for being jealous. And you can't hold yourself accountable to that, too. It's behavior that's impossible for you to enforce. Hard to change. It's hard to change those kinds of desires. I found that section really interesting. And he goes on to say that he, as a minister, has often found it difficult to rejoice with those who rejoice, as the Bible says. And he's often been much better at weeping with those who weep.
Yes.
I think that's true of so many people, that this is like the whole Schadenfreude thing, that it's sometimes hard to feel other people's joy, and it's sometimes easier to weep with those who weep. But I thought you captured it in a really beautiful way. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that the fact of his feeling jealousy in ways that he really can't control or can't rationalize himself out of, so that really the only recourse that he has is more or less to isolate himself when he can from these spectacles of happiness that he feels excluded from. I think that that's important to him in a way, in a positive way, because he is a Calvinist. That is his tradition. And one of the things that tradition teaches is that everyone is wrong. Everyone is flawed. And that the idea that anyone is in a position to judge someone else is a grave error. And his character, of course, is of a kind to make him scrupulous about things like this. But at the same time, I think that his compassion can arise in a great part from the suffering that he feels as someone who cannot help but envy, cannot help but desire.
You've written about John Calvin and Calvinism, and in your novel, the minister says, Calvin says somewhere that each of us is an actor on a stage and God is the audience. That metaphor has always interested me because it makes us artists of our own behavior. And the reaction of God to us might be thought of as aesthetic rather than morally judgmental. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think, why did God create the world? How does he love the world? What in the world, if you imagine him, you know, through the lens of Christ, what in the world breaks his heart? It seems to me as if it's the sort of irreducible beauty and pathos of human beings and their capacity for love and their capacity for loyalty and all the rest that is simply beautiful, even though in many forms it is in error, it is possibly destructive, and so on. I think that, for example, the gallantry of the grandfather, which finally becomes just bizarre and eccentric, is nevertheless beautiful because it is gallant, because it is self-expending, even though the obvious consequences of it are not by any means unambiguous. I think that, again, Calvin would say, if we were actually, you know, or as Hamlet said, you know, who would escape whipping, you know, if we were judged on moral terms, we wouldn't perhaps be worth attracting the notice of God in the way that theology assumes that we do, that it's the beauty of us and not the goodness of us, finally.
So is this almost like a discipline for you to try to focus on that beauty instead of judging people and to find beauty even in tragedy or ugliness?
Yes. Yes, I think that's probably fair to say.
My guest is Marilyn Robinson, and she has a new novel called Gilead. It's her first novel in 23 years since writing Housekeeping. How did you start writing?
That's another odd thing. I think I have always more or less done it since I've been literate. My brother, I have an older brother, 2.5 years older than I, who's a professor at the University of Virginia in art history. And when we were little kids, he was my closest friend, largely because we lived in very remote places sometimes. And he was always painting, and he was always reading, and he was always coming home from school with any information that he had, re-instructing me in whatever it was that he'd learned and so on. And he said to me one time, we both did both of these things, but he said to me one time, I'll be the painter and you be the poet. And I thought, it's a good idea. So I wrote poetry. He was utterly invaluable to me as a child, in my childhood, you know, amazing. But in any case, I did write a lot of poetry, which was good for a child and bad for anybody else. And I realized pretty soon that I would never mature as a poet. And I started writing fiction, more or less, because poetry obviously was not my thing to do.
Now, you're first novel, Housekeeping, was 23 years ago,
mm-hmm.
And now, 23 years later, you have your second novel. You've written in between, but not a novel. So why did it take that long to write another novel?
Well, it didn't really take that long. It just was not what I wanted to do during that period of time.
Mm.
I don't want to make that sound more intentional than it actually was, but the things that were on my mind during that time tended to express themselves in essays. And I've written lots of essays. Sometime I'm going to put them all together. I'm sure I have at least one more book, you know. But in any case, I fiddled with fiction. I didn't find it interesting to me then, what I was doing. And then, for whatever reason, this novel came to me, and I was very happy to write it. And that's simply how things fell out. It wasn't that I intended one thing or another, or that I had a motive of a describable sort in doing one thing or the other.
Because you're so interested in religion and how religion has played a part in shaping the political and social life of America, I'd like you to share some of your observations about how religion is affecting politics today.
Well, I think there are, you know, it's a complex phenomenon. There are people who declare themselves religious, and then there are people who are religious. And these two groups of people are not necessarily the same people. There's some overlap. I think that in any Western society, religious assumptions inevitably affect politics. I think that there's a tendency now to promote too narrow an idea of what religion consists of and of what religion requires. There's a great deal of novelty, actually, in this contemporary sense of what traditional religion is. I think that it's a delicate question for this country because we have, on the one hand, a unique tradition of pluralism and, in effect, public secularism, no established church and so on. On the other hand, we do have a very pious public. These things have both been true for more than 200 years. It's a delicate thing. I don't think we could probably sit down and figure out how it has worked. but I think that the use of religion as coercive and exclusivist is something that's very well documented historically in this country and in every other country. And It's a volatile issue. It has to be used with a great deal of respect for the religion of other people.
I imagine you've read the Bible, pretty carefully as somebody who's interested in religion and the history of religion, and as someone who's a writer and just as interested in language. Fundamentalists believe that the Bible is a literal truth. And that it's, you know, in erring in its accuracy. As a writer who works so much with metaphor and with implied meaning, I just wonder what your reaction is to a fundamentalist reading of the Bible.
Well, I often wonder. I listen to the self-declared religious people in the culture, and it seems to me as if they they're obsessed with certain passages, 2, 3, 4, to the exclusion of the rest of the literature. You know, I'm struck by how seldom the Sermon on the Mount seems to be alluded to, for example. I think that if you are a scholar of the tradition, you become very aware that the great interpreters are also aware of the great complexity of interpretation. People like Calvin and Luther, both of whom made translations of the Bible, Calvin into Latin, but Luther into German, of course. If you read the commentaries, they know that a word can mean several things, and that in many instances there's no way in the text to make a definitive translation, and that it has to be understood as something that finally the reader determines, and so on. The sola scriptura standard that is so often invoked as if it meant some sort of, free form, free association, actually comes from the fact that it's a complex ancient literature that people with the best knowledge in the world struggle to translate. And therefore, one, the individual reader is highly responsible for the interpretation of many things that are crucial to it.
Well, Marilyn Robinson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Marilyn Robinson's new novel is called Gilead. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.